Centaur Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Scream of Eagles by William W. Johnstone, narrated by J. Rodney Turner. Book 1. Till the sun grows cold, and the stars are old, and the leaves of the judgment book unfold. Bedouin Song. Prologue. Jamie Ian McAllister and his wife Kate were both 15 years old when they were married in the river town of New Madrid, Missouri. They remained married and faithful and true to one another for 45 years. By the time Kate died in Jamie's arms after an outlaw raid on the Colorado town they helped found, Jamie and Kate had produced a houseful of kids and dozens of grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Jamie had already lived longer than many men of that time, but somebody forgot to tell Jamie about that. For a man his age, he was still bull-strong and wang leather tough. His hair was gray, but his heart was young. He used eyeglasses to read fine print, but he sure didn't need glasses to shoot. The loss of Kate hit Jamie harder than anything ever had over the long and tumultuous years. For several weeks after her violent and untimely death, Jamie could not clearly focus on anything except her dying and the lonely grave overlooking McAllister's Valley. He holed up deep in the mountains and let his grief take control for a time. Jamie relived over and over each and every memory shared with Kate, the good and the bad, the laughter and the tears, the pain and the pleasure. The pleasure far outweighed the pain. After a couple of weeks, Jamie began to realize that Kate would not want him doing this. All the grieving in the world would not bring her back from the grave. She was at peace now, having climbed the starry path to be greeted by men above. She would wait there for him. Jamie looked up at the high, cloudless blue of the sky. He sighed and then smiled. "You know what I have to do, Kate. I couldn't live with myself if I didn't do it." "Of course," he said dryly, "I might not live much longer doing it. But I reckon that would be all right, too. 'Cause then I'd be with you." Jamie buckled on his pistols. Twin 44s, Model 60 conversion. He wiped the dust off his rifle, a Winchester Model 68. He tidied up his camp, packed the frame on the pack horse, and saddled up his big, mean-eyed buckskin. One of his grandchildren, he couldn't remember which one, much less the child's name. Kate had always kept track of those things, had named the huge animal Buck. It was turning colder now, with winter not far off. During the weeks that Jamie had spent wrapped in his grief, those responsible for the attack on McAllister's Valley and the death of Kate, the Miles Nelson gang would have scattered like dust in the wind. Any trail would be as cold as the stars. "I got a few good years left in me," Jamie muttered. Buck swung his big head around to look at him. "And I'll use them finding you all. My son Matthew talks of book law and justice. That's his way. I'll have justice my way." He swung easily into the saddle, the movement like a man 20 years younger. "I'll find y'all," Jamie repeated. "And I'll kill you." Overhead, soaring on the winds, an eagle screamed. 1. Jamie topped the crest and looked down at the town nestled deep in the Rockies. Another mining town. A number of buildings with boarded-up windows told him that, already, the gold or the silver was playing out, and the miners were moving on. What made him certain the town was dying was that among the empty buildings were several saloons. "Let's go find you boys a warm stall and some hay to munch on," Jamie spoke to his horse. "You both deserve a good rest. It's cold this day." About 20 degrees above zero, but the ground covered with snow. Jamie wasn't sure, but he thought he had passed the new year in a cave, sitting out a blizzard. That would make it 1870, he muttered, his breath steaming the air. Kate's been gone almost 6 months now. And, he thought, the trail I've been trying to find is as cold as the weather. Almost 6 months. Kate lying cold in her grave. No. He corrected his thoughts as he walked his horses onto the wide street, deep rutted from the wheels of many heavy-laden wagons. That is only the shell that contained the flesh and blood of my Kate. Her soul is with man above, waiting for me. Jamie stabled his horses at the livery and told the man to brush and curry the pack horse. Don't touch Buck, he warned. Me bites and kicks. I wouldn't touch that big ugly son of a bitch for $50, the young man said. He jumped back just in time to avoid the flashing teeth of Buck, who was doing his best to take a chunk out of the liveryman's arm. Don't hurt his feelings, Jimmy cautioned him with a small smile. The smiles were coming more often now, but they were still rare. He's very sensitive. The young man rolled his eyes and began forking hay into the stall, muttering about horses in general, and Buck in particular. Jamie took his rifle and saddlebags and walked up the boardwalk to the only hotel that was still open in the dying town. He checked in and stowed his gear. The desk clerk froze as still as death when he reversed the book and read the name. Jamie Ian McAllister. The legend himself. In person. In his hotel. My God. The clerk took in Jamie's size, big as a mountain. His hair was almost all gray, but the big man moved like a huge puma. The clerk sensed danger shrouding Jamie like clouds on the high peaks. I'll have a haircut and a bath, Jamie said. Where's the barbershop?
Just across the street, sir, to your left as you leave the hotel. May I say that it is an honor to have you here, sir.
But Jamie was already out the door. The clerk called for one of his swampers and told the rummy to spread the news. Man who is not afraid was in town. Jamie soaped and scrubbed and did it again with buckets of hot water. Then he had the barber cut his long hair short. After Jamie had left, the barber carefully swept up the graying hair. There were people who would pay a lot of money for a few strands of the hair of the man many Indians still called Man Who Plays With Wolves. Still others called the living legend Bear Killer. Others called him one big, mean son of a bitch, but never to his face. Dusk was settling over the mountains as Jamie went into the hotel bar and ordered a whiskey. From the good bottle, he told the barkeep. He would linger over the amber liquid, savoring the hard flavor, and then have dinner. The menu on the chalkboard was beef and potatoes. The men who had lined the bar shifted to one side, giving Jamie the entire left side of the long mahogany. Everyone in the West knew the story of the Miles Nelson attack on McAllister's Valley, the death of Kate, and then Jamie was on the prod. After ordering his whiskey, Jamie spoke to no one in the bar, and no one spoke directly to him. A man wearing a star on his coat entered the room, looked at Jamie for a short time, then left. He did not leave because of fear, only because he knew McAllister's reputation and knew Jamie would not deliberately provoke an argument with any innocent citizen. But the marshal also knew there were a couple of old boys in town who thought themselves to be tough, and when they heard that McAllister was in town, they would brace him in hopes of gaining a reputation. The marshal didn't want to be around when that happened. He knew that while the two so-called bad men were strutting around, talking about what they'd do to McAllister, Jamie would just shoot them and be done with it. And when the smoke had cleared, McAllister would go eat supper. The marshal went home to eat his own supper,
and to hell with those two clowns who thought they were tough. In about 15 minutes, or less, they wouldn't be tough. They'd just be dead. And in 2 days, forgotten. Jimmy had just lifted the glass to his lips when the front door banged open and cold air swept through the barroom. Jimmy did not turn his head to see who it was. He had positioned himself so he could watch the front door by using the long mirror behind the bar. Jimmy sighed as he watched the two young men. Trouble, he thought. Local toughs wanting to make a reputation. Go away, boys. Go away. The pair swaggered toward the bar, both of them wearing two guns, low and tied down. Damn, Jimmy thought. The young men bellied up to the bar, and one called for whiskey in too loud a tone. The barkeep slid a bottle down to them. He was being very careful to stay clear of the line of fire. The knot of men at the opposite end of the bar left to take tables. No one wanted to get shot.
Howdy there, old-timer.
The name's Pullen, one of the young men said. Jim Pullen.
You hear to me, I reckon?
Can't say as I am, Jimmy said, after taking a small sip of whiskey. Jimmy was not really a drinking man, but he did enjoy one or two drinks occasionally.
Oh, yeah? You don't get around much, do you?
Well, I reckon a man of your advanced age pretty much has to stay close to hearth and home. Jimmy smiled. There wasn't much of the West he hadn't seen at one time or the other.
Part here is Black Jack Perkins. I know you've heard of him.
Can't say as I am, boy.
Well, he killed a man in Black Hawk, he did.
I'm sorry to hear that, Jimmy said, after taking another sip of whiskey. Terrible thing, having to kill a man.
Huh. Well, I killed my share of men, too. I ain't lost no sleep over it.
Jimmy said nothing. He placed his shot glass on the polished bar and waited. He had left his heavy winter coat up in his room and wore a waist-length leather jacket over a dark shirt, dark trousers and boots. Out of long habit, he had slipped the leather thongs off the hammers of his twin colts before entering the barroom. He waited.
You're Jamie McAllister, ain't you?
Black Jack asked, stepping away from the bar and facing Jamie.
That's right. I've been hearing about you all my life. I'm sick of it. I don't think you've done half of what people say you've done. I think most of it was piff and padoodle. Now, what do you think about that?
Jamie was growing very weary of the pair of would-be toughs, but he didn't want to kill either of them. He turned to face the young man and smiled. He lifted one hand and waggled a finger at Black Jack. Come here, boy. Black Jack strutted up to Jamie, a curious expression on his face. Jamie hit him with the left that produced a sound much like a watermelon struck with the flat side of a shovel. Jerking one of the young man's guns from leather and holding the nearly unconscious Black Jack up between himself and Pullen, Jamie closed the few feet and laid the barrel of the gun against Pullen's head. Jim Pullen hit the floor. His lights turned out. Jamie popped Black Jack again, and Black Jack joined his buddy on the floor for a nap. He took their pistols and walked out back to the privy, dropping the six-shooters down the twin holes. They disappeared forever, with a splash. Back in the bar, the men seated at the tables winced at the power in those big arms as Jamie reached down with both hands and grabbed the sleeping young men by the backs of their shirt collars and dragged them outside, depositing them both in the street. Returning to the warmth of the bar, Jamie signaled the barkeep for another drink and then turned to the crowd. Am I going to have any more trouble here tonight? The men slowly and solemnly shook their heads. Fine, Jamie said, then took his drink into the restaurant and sat down and ordered dinner. Outside, a citizen helped one of the marshal's deputies drag the unconscious young men across the street. The deputy tossed them into a jail cell and slammed and locked the door. Damn fools, the citizen said.
They're lucky McAllister didn't kill them, the deputy said. He may be getting on in years, but that is still one war horse and no man to brace.
Reckon how long he'll stay in town? The citizen questioned.
As long as he damn well pleases, the deputy replied.
It's from Pa,
Matthew shouted with a wide grin, waving the envelope the stage driver had handed him. Matthew looked up at the driver.
Where'd you get this, Luke?
Another driver gave it to me. It's been passed around some, Matt. I figure it's taken near about 2 months to get here.
Matthew sat down on the porch of the Goldman Mercantile Store and carefully opened the envelope. Abe and Rebecca Goldman were long dead, the store now operated by their youngest son, Tobias. The entire town, more than 500 people, soon gathered around, waiting in silence as Matthew read the letter.
"Pa's well," Matthew finally said.
Matthew was one of triplets, Matthew, Morgan, and Megan, born in 1832.
"Pa was in Central City when he wrote this. He's picked up the trail of some of the Nelson gang and was leaving out for Wyoming next morning."
"What's the date?"
Matt's youngest sister, Jolene, asked.
"There ain't any. Hush up and listen."
"Don't tell me to shush, you ox."
"Shut up, the both of you,"
Jimmy Ian told his brother and sister.
"Read," he told Matt.
"There ain't much more."
"Isn't,"
Jolene corrected. Matt sighed and returned to the letter.
"Pa says to tend to Ma's gravesite and plant some flowers around about. He says if he comes back here and finds the site all grown up with weeds, somebody's butt is going to be in trouble."
He looked up into the faces of his brothers and sisters, in-laws and nieces and nephews and what have you.
"That's it."
"I wonder where Pa is now," Megan said.
"Atlantic City," Jamie read the faded wooden sign, "welcomes you."
Jamie had bypassed South Pass City, giving it a wide berth and riding on toward Atlantic City. He had heard that several of the men he was seeking were loafing around that mining town, gambling and whoring and making trouble. Jamie was about to put an end to all that. The government had recently started building a fort near Atlantic City. It would be named Fort Stambaugh, after a first lieutenant who had been killed by Indians near Miner's Delight. It would be abandoned in 8 years. After the raid on McAllister's Valley, the Miles Nelson gang had broken up and scattered. The Pinkertons and Wells Fargo detectives, many sheriffs and town marshals all over the West, as well as federal marshals and the U.S. Army, were after them. With the gold and money taken from the bank and the stagecoach, the gang members could live well for a couple of years. By then, the heat would be off them, and they could regroup. Or so they thought. But they hadn't taken into consideration one Jamie Ian McAllister, dogging their trail, riding with hardened revenge, burning in his trail-wise eyes. When the gang had struck McAllister's Valley, the Nelson gang was the largest in all the West. Actually, there were 5 gangs, each with about 15 men, robbing and raping and looting and burning, from Kansas to California. Miles had pulled them all together for the raid that killed Jamie's wife. 20 of the gang had been killed, wounded, or captured during the raid in the valley. That left about 55 outlaws still on the loose. 55 of the meanest, sorriest, most worthless dredges of humanity ever assembled. It had taken Jamie about 6 months to do it, but he had put together a list of men who were part of the Miles Nelson gang. To do so, he had visited with every sheriff and marshal in every town he passed through, looking at dodgers and talking with men in lockup. A rustler might steal your cattle, but when it came to raping and killing women, shooting little kids down in the street, that was going too far. And most of the men in jail talked to Jamie. Jamie had a list of 51 names, and if it took him the rest of his life, he was going to visit each name. After the visit, he would draw a line through that man's name. These men had robbed him of the most precious thing in his life. Kate. and if it cost him his own life checking off those names, well, so be it. Without Kate, he was nothing. Just nothing at all. 2. Army troops were hard at work building the new fort when Jamie rode past. The post would be located a few miles outside the town, just north and slightly east of Rock Creek. In the spring of 1870, Atlantic City had a population of over 2,000, mostly miners, gamblers, thieves, con men, and whores. Like most boom towns, it was a wild and woolly place, and you took your life in your own hands, venturing out after dark. Jamie stabled his horses, worked out an arrangement with the livery owner to sleep in the loft. The hotels and boarding houses were all packed full with varying degrees of humanity, and went to see the town marshal. The marshal knew who he was the instant Jamie stepped into his office. Jamie Ian McAllister was a true living legend. Books had been written about him, songs had been sung, and several plays on the life and times of Jamie Ian McAllister had been produced. "My name is McAllister," he informed the marshal and his two deputies, closing the door behind him. The bulk of him was huge in the room. "I'll be in your town for no more than a couple of days. I'm here looking for two men. When I've found them, I'll move on. I think you know why I'm here, so there is no need for me to repeat the story. I respect the law. One of my sons is a sheriff down in Colorado. But sometimes, the law just doesn't work. I'm here to see that it does. That's all I have to say. Good day, gentlemen." Jamie stepped out onto the warped boardwalk and closed the door behind him. The marshal looked at his two officers. "Stay out of McAllister's way. When you go tell the undertaker he's about to have some business." Jamie found the men in the first saloon he entered. They were sitting in the rear, a bottle of whiskey and two glasses on the table between them. "Hubby Joyner and Jesse Maxwell," Jamie called. "Stand up and face me, you murdering bastards." The distance between the bat wings and the rear table cleared in two heartbeats. No one wanted to get caught in the crossfire. The two outlaws stood up, hands hovering over the butts of their guns. They both had known that Jamie was after them. That news had spread all up and down the Hoot Owl Trail. But neither one of them had worried much about it. They were in their early 30s. McAllister's hair was gray, and he had to be knocking on an old man's door. No way he was going to take two men half his age. Hubby grinned, exposing tobacco-stained and rotten teeth. "You best go on back home now, old man. Get in your rocking chair and pull a shawl over your knees." "Yeah," Jesse said. "Where'd you leave your cane, old man? You best find it, before you fall over." Jamie's smile was hard. "You men were part of the gang that raided McAllister's Valley last year. You killed a number of people, including my wife, Kate. Now hook and draw, you sorry sons of bitches." The two outlaws would never know that Jamie Ian McAllister was probably the West's first fast draw. They had no way of knowing they were facing the man who mastered the technique. Their hands had just closed around the butts of their guns when Jamie's Colts spat fire and smoke and lead. Hubby Joyner sat down in the chair he'd just risen out of and died, a very odd expression on his face as he looked down at the hole in his chest. Jesse Maxwell stumbled backward against the wall and dropped his Remingtons to the floor. He slid down until his butt touched the floor. There, he died. Every eyeball in the saloon clicked toward Jamie. The big man holstered his guns and said, "There'll be money in their pockets. It belongs to Wells Fargo and to the bank in Valley, Colorado. Turn the money over to your marshal." Jamie walked outside to stand for a moment on the boardwalk. Across the street, the marshal and his officers had stepped out of the office at the sounds of the gunfire. They watched as Jamie unfolded a sheet of paper and took a pencil from his vest pocket. He drew a line on the paper, then carefully folded it and returned it to his inside pocket. Then he walked across the street to a cafe and ordered a cup of coffee and a slice of cake. A miner ran across the street, peeked into the cafe, then trotted down to where the marshal stood and told the men what happened. "And McAllister is a mighty cold man," one of the marshal's men remarked. "That's a man who saw his wife shot down before his eyes," the marshal responded. "Miles Nelson should have had more sense than to attack McAllister's valley. Before that man yonder's done, he's going to leave a bloody trail behind him." "You blame him?" the miner asked. The marshal slowly shook his head. "Not one bit." Eastern newspapers quickly picked up on Jamie's vendetta and assigned reporters to travel west and cover the story. The leading newspaper in Boston assigned a Negro reporter, at his insistence, to cover it. Ben Franklin Washington, unclaimed son of Ann Woodville, whose real name was Ann Jefferson, and whose parents were runaway slaves, was determined to stir up a hornet's nest. Ben was high yellow, but Negro nonetheless. He knew his mother had abandoned him at birth, knew his sister had passed for white all her life, and was now married to one of Jamie Ian McAllister's grandkids. Ben knew his real mother, in cahoots with his uncle, had tried to have him killed in Richmond, Virginia. Ben Franklin Washington had no reason to love any member of his family. He was going to do his best to upset as many apple carts as he could. And he was going to love every minute of it. Ben's mother, now living in San Francisco and going under the name of Andrea Petrie, read with much interest the greatly embellished newspaper account of Jamie's hunt for the Nelson gang. She laid the paper aside and shook her head. Kate was dead, and Jamie was on the warpath. Incredible. Kate had been a good person, one of the few people in the world that Andrea had respect for. And Jamie? Well, the man had to be in his late 50s at least. But Andrea knew that Jamie would be a man to be reckoned with, no matter what his age. It was all very interesting. She would follow this bizarre story closely. Her thoughts shifted to her brother. Andrea had hired private detectives in an attempt to find Ross, but so far, no luck. She wondered where in the world he might be living. Her brother Ross, now living under the name of Russell Clay, opened the Denver paper, adjusted his reading glasses, and carefully read the story about Jamie and the manhunt. Kate dead. He shook his head. Hard to believe. She had been such a vivacious woman, so full of life, and a genuinely nice person. The world had lost a lovely flower with her passing. A real shame. The dozen or so reporters from back east gathered at Valley, Colorado. They had decided, and it was a wise move, that if they were going to go traipsing around the Wild West, where red savage Indians abounded, there was strength in numbers. Valley now boasted a population of over 600, if one counted all the dogs and cats. A nice-sized town for the time and the place. It was a little off the beaten path, but quite a fine town once you got there. Mining, farming, and cattle and sheep ranching surrounded the area. The town had a weekly newspaper, the Valley Dispatch, and the visiting reporters were amazed at how professional the writing was. They were equally amazed at how damn many McAllisters there were in Valley. At least half the population had blonde hair and blue eyes. Everyone seemed to be related. The mayor was a McAllister. Morgan. The sheriff was a McAllister. Matthew. There were five deputies, and three of them were related to the McAllisters. Half the town council was related to the McAllisters. Jamie and Kate had 9 kids living. Each of them had married and had about 6 or 7 kids. Many of those kids were now of marrying age.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?